Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig, and we wish you a happy Hanukkah, a Merry Christmas, Kwanzaa, and everything else is happening at this on the 25th of December.
And Ann was just bursting out singing, but I stopped her. And then I started, and she stopped me. So you're
in good shape.
Yeah, you're doubly relieved of the responsibility to listen.
And
listen
at this
to
time
us.
Of year, what we end up doing is, we tie up loose ends whole year. This is concluding our 13th year of broadcast.
Oh my God, it's amazing.
It is amazing.
And I'll bet many of you have been with us all that time, and we're so glad you have been, and that you'll be ready for the 14th year coming up. Next week,
yes.
but what do we have today?
We
have an outstanding.
I mean, I loved talking.
No, saying something, and you just.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No, I was actually going to get a word in edgeways, but now I won't. No, you go ahead.
I was saying we had so much fun with the guests that we're featuring today.
We did.
Katie Button is just a delight. I mean, you hear about her, but she's getting a lot of ink, as I point out in the introduction to our interview, but she's just delightful. Anyhow, we're going to talk to her, and we're going to then move on to Los Angeles, California.
Yes, we are, and then we're going to finish up with a Frenchman who's revolutionizing baking in England.
Right.
How about that for a lineup?
Global concepts, yes.
Yeah, so let's start off with Katie Button.
I think Katie Button agrees with me that she's gotten an awful lot of press lately. She has a wonderful book out called Curate, and it's authentic Spanish food from an American kitchen. Katie, you really have earned your media attention, I must say, though. You started out as a scientist, right?
Yes, that's correct. I'm definitely a career changer.
Yeah, well, you know, a lot of chefs, I mean, we have one friend who was he a neurophysicist or something? Some kind of strange physicist. And then Joanne Chang was, what was she?
She was a consultant before that. She was a chemist, I think.
A chemist. I mean, it must go together. And then on the other half of the spectrum, a lot of us started out as art historians and ended up with food. Like Ruth Reichel, we both have masters in art history from the University of Michigan.
They're part of the school that leads eventually to the job where you ask, "Would you like fries with that, sir?"
I love that. Yeah, exactly.
So, but just run down briefly this kind of fairy tale life you constructed for yourself.
Sure. So, I was born in South Carolina. My grandparents had retired there.
In Greenville, no less, by the way, which we know very well.
Yes, exactly. Lived there as a little girl and then moved up to the New Jersey, New York area and ended up going to school at Cornell and studied chemical and biomolecular engineering. And then a graduate who has no idea what they want to do because they're not super interested in their in what they studied, you know, I kept studying it. So I got a master's degree at biomedical engineering at École Centrale in Paris, France. But let's be honest, it was an excuse to live in Paris.
Exactly.
And then I got all the way applied and accepted into a PhD program in neuroscience before I veered off track and decided that, you know, I hadn't been happy doing that in a while, and it was scary looking at a 7-year PhD program followed by the rest of my life, and so I dropped out right before it was supposed to start and immediately jumped into the restaurant industry.
Which you lucked out on some good connections in the restaurant industry, and you also had a bonus called Felix.
Yes, I did. My husband, Felix, I met him shortly after I started working in D.C. at Jose Andres' restaurant, Cafe Atlantico Mini Bar. And, you know, he works in front of the house service and beverage. And, you know, as soon as the two of us met, he supported my dreams. And we just started working together and planning our future together.
Now that's amazing. It is a dream world, isn't it?
Well, now hold on. Now we made another left turn. Called this is the next question is, how did you get from Washington D.C. working for Jose Andres to Asheville, North Carolina?
Well, now you missed out on the part with El Bulli.
There are some parts in between, so
right.
Yes.
Perhaps they're part of the explanation.
I got there by way of Spain, so Felix, my husband, he'd been working at El Bulli, you know, the famed restaurant Ferran Adrià, that was the best restaurant in the world at the time, and he was working in front of the house service there, and so he was supposed to go back because the restaurant was open 6 months in the summer and then closed, you know, 6 months out of the year, and he was getting ready to go back. And he offered to me, you know, how would you like to go live with me in Spain and work at the best restaurant in the world?
Oh,
and
man.
I was like, wow, yes, for sure. So I went and, you know, worked in as a server first because I didn't have any professional cooking experience to make it into the kitchen at the time. But it's really there that I knew that, one, the restaurant industry was definitely for me, and two, I really wanted to make my way onto the other side and cook. Grew up with a mother who had a catering business.
Oh, yeah, so I forgot about that.
Yeah, cooking had been a really big part of my life, just not professionally.
Now, where did you live when you were working at El Bulli? Where did you live?
In Rosas. Huh?
I lived in Rosas.
You lived in the little town.
In the little town, it's a small town that El Bulli is located in, which is actually my husband Felix's hometown. So living there and working and having lunch with his mother.
Oh, nice!
We went there in, was it 2000?
Yeah,
we went there. We drove over the hills and far away, and it was pretty frightening going because the road's kind of narrow and twisty and twiny.
Hi.
And totally scary, but beautiful. Yeah.
Then it was time to go home, and we hadn't thought much about that. But they brought our car up for us to get in and drive, and Anne said, "Oh, I'll drive."
Oh my goodness!
I said, "The hell you will."
You
have no idea where we're going. She was asleep in 45 seconds.
Oh my goodness, that is hilarious.
So I didn't have her to confirm that I was making the right turns, but we made it okay.
Yeah, we did.
We lived to tell the tale.
Now, you worked also with Albert Adrià, isn't he a doll?
He is. He's amazing. Yeah, he's the one who really was, you know, I mean, everybody was, but he was really supportive of me coming back and working to make it into the kitchen at El Bulli. And he's so talented and such a great mentor. After I left El Bulli, I went and worked. I interned at Jean Georges in New York while living on my parents' sofa. And then
we know about
from
that one.
There, worked at the Bazaar by Jose Andres in Los Angeles. And then went back to work at El Bulli in the kitchen.
There we go.
A wondrous trail here.
Yes.
But you didn't get to Asheville yet.
No. So after that, you know, we were talking about opening. My mother actually was the one. She'd been talking about opening a restaurant. She'd been in the industry. It had been a dream of hers to have her own restaurant. And we were discussing that, and she asked Felix and I to come help her. And we looked all over, you know, the South, because my grandparents were still living there. And I think we all just felt really connected to the South Carolina, North Carolina area. And we came through Asheville and just fell in love with it. I mean, the Blue Ridge Mountains and the rivers and waterfalls and vibrant downtown. And it felt like it was a place that was growing. And that was in 2008, right? Right when most of the country was
growing. Yeah, you weren't opening restaurants. Right.
So we decided that was where we wanted to be and where we were going to open a restaurant. And as soon as we got there, you know, originally the idea was helping my mother with a restaurant. But when we got there, you know, my parents, we all sat down and we all started talking about going into business together, the four of us. And as soon as that happened, Felix and I just ran with this Spanish tapas idea and developed the concept for Curate.
Well, you know, these recipes are...
And that's the concept for the restaurant also.
Yes. Both... exactly. Curate, so the name of the restaurant is Curate, which means cure yourself in Spanish, and it's a Spanish
Mentioned that in your book, and I I hadn't figured that out, the verb out yet. Just yeah, secure yourself. And that's great.
So it's both the name of the restaurant and the name of the book, because the book is our first cookbook based on the restaurant.
And well, I said these are essentially, they're Spanish essential foods. I mean, if you are in love with a particular dish, pretty much you'll find it in this book of the traditional, like the tomato bread.
Yes.
You know, somehow I never thought of it as a dish you could share. I always thought of it as a tapa.
I know. No, it's great. Yeah. It's, all the recipes in the book, you know, are written for home and families at home. They're not tapas recipes, you know, while they're converted from a restaurant that, you know, does tapas. The dishes in Spain are, you know, in the culture that I was familiar with and learned, it was eating at home with families and my husband's family. And that's really where the inspiration for Curuté and the book came from. And the recipes are representative of that.
So this is not El Bulli food.
No.
This is not ours.
There is a fun technique, actually, that I did for home that was created off of a technique that we used to do at El Bulli using a whipped cream siphon and making a whipped mayonnaise. It was a recipe that I learned from El Bulli, and for the home cook, it's white asparagus with whipped mayonnaise with lemon vinaigrette and tarragon. And for the home cook, I came up with this awesome technique of basically you make a mayonnaise, but you whip your eggs like you would in a standing mixer, like you would for a cake, until they quadruple in volume, and then you fold in your vinegar and mustard and salt and oil, and it makes this wonderfully luxurious kind of sabayon texture mayonnaise sauce for your white asparagus.
Oh, that's wonderful, huh?
Now, one of the things I will observe about it is you better like pork. You better like pig if you're going to cook out of this book.
Well, here's Peter's favorite, the croquettes. You love croquettes.
Oh, yeah. But I'm cooking for a chef on Sunday who just came to this area. He was recruited by Michel Nichan, who you probably know on the cooking circuit.
Yeah.
So when Michel placed this young man called Sam at a new restaurant in a newly revived hotel in the outskirts of Pittsburgh. So we invited him to dinner, and I invented a recipe recently, but it was sort of missing something. So I looked up in the index, what does she have that's a pork braise? So I found a pork braise. And we were just looking for one more ingredient, weren't we? What else can we put in here? We tried carrots. No, carrots would change the flavor too much. Black beans would be fine, but doesn't add a lot of interest. So I found a recipe that has collard greens in it.
Yes.
It's called the Southern Vegetable Meats, the Costa Brava.
exactly correct.
And I have the last few collard green leaves that have grown in the garden, so they're going to go into it.
I love it. That's perfect. I love that stew recipe has inspired your pork braised dish.
Yes.
That's amazing.
You know, I even asked Anya von Bresnan this. I never understood Russian potato salad in Spain. I mean, why do we have Russian potato salad everywhere in Spain?
I don't know, but it has.
She didn't know either, and she's Russian.
I know.
And
I don't know.
Expert in Spanish cooking.
But it's very popular.
It's extremely
everywhere.
Popular. In fact, it's my standard for figuring out if a tapas bar is worth staying and ordering more things.
Yeah, so, you said that. So
you check it out, huh?
Yeah, exactly.
But, I mean, so you don't know the history of it either.
I don't, unfortunately.
Yeah,
it's something that I've looked up but haven't been able to find an exact path because there's so many different, I don't know, I think it's been changed from the traditional Russian-type salad. So,
yeah, it's really funny. When I was growing up in England, one of the canned goods that was frequently served with like a late afternoon salad meal was what they call a vegetable salad, and it was very similar to...
It was, yeah.
Very, very similar to this Russian salad.
It had peas and...
Yeah, peas and carrots and things like that chopped up in it, and in some kind of sauce. I don't know. You wouldn't call it Russian dressing in England, but it was some kind of sauce like salad cream all mixed up together.
Mayonnaise-based sauce.
Mayonnaise, some kind of mayonnaise-based. But it had to come out of a can. It was like, it's like cranberry sauce.
Really?
Yeah. It's like cranberry sauce. It had to come out of the can with the can marks on it.
Oh.
The one that, the recipe that I actually don't know from Spain, I never had, I've had escabeche, but I never had chilled mussels in escabeche sauce.
So it's a funny dish, because in Spain, you know, they have these mussels in escabeche sauce. They're usually canned and they're already prepared. And
yes.
You've already got, like, you buy your can of mussels, like, in this vinaigrette that's got these kind of tomato and garlic flavors and things going on in that vinaigrette. And my husband, when he was in the army, because back when it was required when he was young, and in the time that he spent in the army, it was his go-to, like, escape from mess hall food. He would get a can of these mussels in escabeche, dump them out on a baguette, and eat a chilled, like, mussel sandwich. And I love that story.
I like that too.
Yeah, and the dish that we created for the book, though, I do it with fresh mussels, and you, blanch them and then chill them and open them up and top them with a vinaigrette that you make from cooking tomato, garlic, onion, and herbs.
You know, if we're looking abstractly at the whole preserved, tinned, canned, jarred foods, the Spaniards managed to do just everything well in that category, don't they?
They really do, and I mean, they really consider them a delicacy. I mean, that the white asparagus, for example, like, I think white asparagus is better canned than fresh. You know, it's this, they have this tradition, and they do too. And you know, I think it's just they hand pack a lot of their canned, like, really good canned items.
Uh-huh.
And it's just a different way. We think of canning as mass production, industrialization, like, throw things in a can and, you know, ruin the end product. But in Spain, they just think of it as another method of preserving ingredients and seafood and maintaining their freshness and, flavor in a different way.
Well, they had a real spread at this International Star Chefs in Brooklyn.
Yeah,
they had
some wonderful sliced octopus.
Yeah, well, I'm looking at this octopus.
I wanted to respond to something before we go by. You remember the first time we went to Spain, and after we were in Madrid, we drove to Bilbao because we were going to the Guggenheim, and we stopped in this little town called Santiago de something or other, which is known for having two live chickens inside the church. But it was this little village, and all the shops in the village had two things in the window: white asparagus and
what was the other one?
Bataga.
That's all they had.
Like, mountains of white asparagus and bataga. It's like, this is the only thing these people in this town eat.
Well, I'll tell you, I get hungry for these things. I miss them. Just seeing them in your book, like, I haven't had stuffed squid for years. I think we'll have to make some of those and use your recipe.
The problem is getting decent squid.
I know.
Yeah.
But now we found some people. I'm looking at your preparing octopus section where, mm-hmm. I mean, I had to use, I don't know how many different books to figure out what to do with this octopus that the fish store talked me into getting. I mean, I remember being in Spain and somebody was always boiling up an octopus, you know. But to do it myself without having them really prepare it, I had no idea. So you have it all in here. You have the beak, you have everything.
But there's a company in Long Island which imports octopus
from Spain.
From, I think mostly they come from the Canary Islands. And they're pre-beaten. So the right. the deal says the people, the fishermen catch them and beat them.
they have some proprietary technique.
And then they send them to Long Island, from which they're distributed. And I think our Whole Foods store has octopus again today, but it's $15 a pound.
I wouldn't pay that for octopus.
It's a ridiculous amount of money to pay for an octopus.
Yeah.
I know, exactly. It's true that they do tenderize them before they freeze them and ship them over here. But I definitely wanted to do the step-by-step instructions of how to cook and cut and portion an octopus in the book.
Well, you did a great job because you can't just throw it in a big pot of water or anything. You've got to prepare it. You've got to trim out this beak and all this stuff.
Well, you also have to put it in your food saver bag so you can flatten it out.
Katie, you'd love that if you have a food saver. I mean, we used to think that you had to freeze it before you cooked it to tenderize it because you didn't have rocks to beat it on. But
exactly.
I put it in a food saver bag and did vacuum. And the poor thing, everything, the little suckers shrunk up. And the whole thing was a 2D object.
And then she put it in the pot of boiling water, and it suddenly became three-dimensional or four-dimensional.
And I screamed. It was crawling out of the pan. Tell me, what's your favorite? You have so many wonderful recipes. What's your go-to recipe in your own kitchen?
My go-to recipe is the tortilla española, potato and onion, you know, kind of egg omelet frittata type dish. And the reason is because it's become I have a daughter, she's almost 2 years old, and, you know, it's turned into my, like, refrigerator clean out from a week's worth of cooked vegetables piling up. You know, so at the end of the week, I make it almost a couple times a month at least, and I'll go in my refrigerator whenever I have a bunch of cauliflower, broccoli or something, and substitute those vegetables for the quantity of potato that the recipe calls for, and then make it out of that, because you can really make it out of anything. And it's so delicious for lunch, dinner, a snack, an appetizer, any time of day. So that's become my, the recipe I cook the most at home.
It's the standard fare at the breakfast buffet at the Paradores all across Spain, isn't it?
Exactly. Yes.
So if it's not there yet on the buffet, you know it's coming soon.
I love the Paradores in Spain and their amazing breakfasts that they have.
So anyhow, you have a whole section on paella too. I mean, we actually watched the Valencianas. They had a restaurant in the middle of a rice field, and they were doing the paella, cooking outside on the wood fires. And it was wonderful. So you do that too. You don't mix up your paella, do you?
No, I do. I do that too. I love that. In paella, when I'm doing, like, having friends over and cooking for a group, it's the dish I cook more frequently because I love that it's, like, all in one pot.
Yes.
And what I'll usually do is, like, go ahead and have all my vegetables and meat and everything, like, cut and ready and make my mise en place. And then when everybody's there, you know, a half an hour into kind of the gathering beginning, I'll just start cooking. And it's a nice thing to be able to cook and talk to people and do it outside and have some fun with your guests, and they really enjoy seeing it.
Well, if anybody's craving that, I don't know, it's a Spanish air. I don't know what it is, but there's something about Spanish food that's just so celebratory, and you capture it in this book. So I hope everybody takes advantage of what all the work you put into this for everybody. And it's, again, Katie Button is the chef, and it's Curate, which is the book and her restaurant. And, you know, we have people that come to your town all the time from Pittsburgh. I don't know if you know that. They have houses there.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, so anyhow, I'll be able to tell them where to go eat.
Amazing. Thank you
and
so
I love
much.
I love your sandwiches, too, which is really good. Those are really good.
Yeah.
Katie, I really enjoyed talking to you, and I love your cookbook, and keep us posted.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it, and thank you for having me on today.
Yes.
And don't go away, because we'll be back after a short break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. Next up, we have George Geary, who is not only an accomplished chef, but in this particular role, he is, such a wonderful raconteur, telling us about the legendary restaurants in Los Angeles, where all the celebrities of the time ate, drank, and played. So hold on to your chairs and get ready for a very glamorous romp through Tinseltown. George Geary, I was delighted to get this book that you just produced, L.A.'s Legendary Restaurants, Celebrating the Famous Places Where Hollywood Ate, Drank, and Played. A lot of playing going on, too. This, I said to you right off the bat, this had been a lot of work. I mean, most of these places haven't been around for a long time.
You're absolutely right. It's about 4 years. In total.
Wow.
Now, why did you get interested in the first place, George? I mean it's a little off the beaten track as a subject. Even though I can see how it fascinated you once you got started, because it fascinated me once I got started reading it.
Yeah, it's an architecture book a little bit. It's historical. It's Hollywood. It's recipes. It's a lot of stories of history of the locations and stars intertwined. And I got involved with it and excited when I was a kid, really. I grew up in the Hollywood area, not very far. And one of my first jobs was in a pastry kitchen that provided cakes for a lot of the restaurants in the 1980s. And back in the 80s, I noticed a lot of restaurants closing down. The old stars weren't going places like that anymore, and they were tearing the buildings down. So that's where I started thinking of what could we do about it.
It was a little bit like Joni Mitchell, how they paved paradise and made it a parking lot. and indeed, they did that with some of these really celebrated restaurants, which were it not for you, would be really not only dead but gone.
Right. And when I mentioned that I was doing this book to a number of people, the first thing they said was, "Are you putting the Brown Derby in?"
Oh, yeah.
Because that was the number one book or item that people thought. And that was another thing. I found an antique cookbook from the 30s, 40s, around in there, and it was all about the Brown Derby. And that pushed it into for me to start researching more.
Yeah, well, this is a question you said right at the start that everybody was asking, because this book is not, I should say this book is worth buying just for the photographs of all these ancient celebrities. But in addition to that, you've got the recipes of their famous dishes. And the first question anybody's going to ask you is, especially with all the ones that are closed, how did you get these recipes?
I was fortunate to, Russ Parsons over at the LA Times, they had a column questions of people asking for famous recipes of restaurants and things like that. So there was that. There was a number of cookbooks that the Los Angeles Times put out over the years, probably about 5 or 6. And then Bon Appetit also had that same type of thing, asking for recipes.
Right.
And then a number of the restaurants put out their own cookbooks years and years ago. There were a few restaurants that wouldn't provide me any recipes that are still around.
You had a hard time with the chocolate sundae, didn't you?
Yeah, I had a hard time with that family.
I never did get the...
Whoever they are, they shall be nameless on the program.
I don't know why they should be nameless, because it's one of the recipes everybody's going to want.
Well, who is it then? Yeah.
Well, it's C.C. Brown's. They're the first people in my cookbook. They started years and years ago in the early 1900s, 1906. They closed in 96. In fact, the New York Times did a whole story about them closing down. And they had a family of kids, and the kids didn't really care about the place. So as soon as the parents had passed away, they sold the place over to, almost 100 years later, to Lowry's Restaurants.
Now, that was an interesting thread that you did with the Lowry's. Remember the original seasoned salt? Who's the other one with them now?
Lowry's Prime Rib, and then the other restaurant that I have that was part of the Lowry's family is the Tam O'Shanter.
Right.
The Vandekamp family.
That's right. The Vandekamp, which I only knew from frozen fish.
Fish sticks, yeah. And that is just secondary. They started as a bakery. In fact, my grandmother and my aunt worked there.
Yeah, you said
Yeah, I have a picture of my aunt in one of the pictures. We couldn't find one of my grandmother. The Vandekamp's was it started in 1915, and they had these little windmill stores, and they had bread.
I see. I'm looking at this photograph. It's hard to believe, isn't it?
And in fact, I was driving in Los Angeles probably about 3 years ago down a Figueroa in kind of a dicey part of town.
Yeah.
And I see this liquor store on a corner, and I look up and I can kind of see that it used to be a windmill. And I thought that was one of the locations.
Well, I love that. Go ahead, finish your sentence.
It was one of the locations. After I looked up, I had been downtown Los Angeles at the library looking through all the old phone books. I found the address, and sure enough, that was one of them.
Well, I should point out that you have, like, each restaurant you list, and it's illustrious history. You have a little box where you have the name, the dates it was running, address, and the original phone numbers, which include letters, the type of cuisine, who designed the building, and the building style and the current use. But the building style, I laughed so hard when I read this. You called the building style Dutch Renaissance Revival. I'm an art historian, so I think most people won't get how funny that is. It's a windmill, folks.
but what's interesting, the Dutch Renaissance Revival is that technically not those little windmills, it was the plant that has a big picture where they started the big building.
You mean the flowers?
The one that is now a college.
Oh, yes, that's this one. Enormous.
No,
you're
it's
right.
funny.
It is actually. I see it now. It looks like Amsterdam. Yeah.
You know, we skipped something. We skipped something. It'd be a good idea to interject here, because your book is about Los Angeles in an era where most Americans wouldn't even recognize it. Because now it's a monster metropolis with cars everywhere, but back in the day, as they call it, I've never really understood back in the day or back in the night, it really was not a very big town at all, was it?
No, not like it is now. just like I'm looking outside my window right now in Atlanta, because I'm here in town, and this city's changed. All the big skyscrapers that weren't here even 10 years ago when I was here. So
poor Atlanta, never met a city planner.
I don't think LA had a lot of city planning that went into
too.
It either.
But you know, all these, like, you have some restaurants that, believe it or not, are still running, like Musso and Frank Grill.
Yeah, we have a handful that are still open. Uh-huh. I originally thought I'd have everything that was closed, but Lowry's is the one that changed my idea and added places in that were still open, because Lowry's has a place called Tam O'Shanter, and it was the oldest family still running. I think 1912 is the year, and somewhere around in there. And I thought, you know, they gave me so much information. They gave me recipes. They gave me a lot of pictures for the book. And I thought, well, that's a piece of history I don't want to not include.
Right.
So that's why I did put a few. And Musso and Frank's on Hollywood Boulevard has so much history also, that I thought, you know, there's stories that need to be told, so I can change the scope of the book a little bit and just not have all of them that are gone. We've got a few that you can still go in and see.
Now, most of the people in the photographs, most of them are gone.
Some. I've got, like in Musso and Frank's, we've got Manny, the bartender.
That's a good story.
Now, I was talking more about the movie stars.
Oh, yeah, the movie stars. Yeah, I don't have any. I do talk about a few movie stars that are still around, but they aren't in the book in pictures, per se. If you look today, we don't have a lot of restaurants in Hollywood that movie stars flock to like they did in the 40s and 50s.
Right, no.
It's
a different era, but the interesting thing is who was sort of thrown together in your pictures.
Mm-hmm.
And some of them are couples like Desi Arnaz and Lucille Ball. But then you have people from different walks of life.
Yeah, and you have Marilyn Monroe with Lucille Ball in one picture.
Yeah.
Where you didn't even think, were they never acted together? Were they
I never
friends?
Thought of them at all, no.
Yeah, I mean, you can sort of make up, you can get things going in your head, because you wonder, I always wondered, you know, why did Marilyn Monroe marry Joe DiMaggio?
Yeah.
How would they have ever met? And it turns out that at least in several cases in this book, they met in your book.
Well, yeah, they did. And in fact, I talk about their marriage in one of the locations that they had one of their bridal parties or something at one of the places.
I'm going to tell you a story here. This is a story worth telling. Anne's probably going to kill me, but we were in a hotel in Chicago on one occasion. We drove into the automobile lobby, which is where you were going to park. We got out of the car and we were walking to the elevator. And there was this rather distinguished-looking white-haired gentleman who was walking in the same direction. And Anne said, "You look familiar."
Mm-hmm.
And he said, "The name's DiMaggio." And do you,
that might be why.
But do you know how she recognized him? She recognized him because he was having a moment of fame late in life as a spokesperson for Mr. Coffee Makers.
Yeah. Yeah, I think he probably did better at Mr. Coffee than he did as a baseball player.
Probably because they didn't pay them. Much. Yeah,
he probably won a lot of money, but he didn't become quite as famous, right?
Which is I'm trying to remember which the restaurant was that was so famous, and they never ever took, and they were open a long time. And they never took credit cards or checks, only cash. Who's that?
Oh well.
Probably more than one of them. I should
have. No, there's only one in here.
I'm thinking of Peter Luger's in New York, but boy, Chasen's.
Chasen's
could have been it. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, funny. This is a gorgeous photograph of Loretta Young. Yeah, you know, it's also a sort of an archive of fashions of the time. But the other thing is, I mean, all the quirks of the characters involved in the restaurants, but you also have, like, dishes that the restaurants made famous, like Cobb salad.
Yeah, and I have, like, the original of how it was done, not like diners do it today. Today we see a large bowl with it stacked up pyramid style with rows of cheese or, you know, things. Uh-huh. And the Cobb salad originally was all chopped up, and it was in rows, but it was in a long platter, and they did it tableside. And they pretty much ask you, did you want eggs in it? Did you want tomatoes in it? It was more of a, what, kind of like a salad bar tableside. Uh-huh. And they would toss it in a big bowl that way over at the Brown Derby did that. But I have a few originals. The Moscow Mule.
Yeah,
that was the first place it was created, was over at the Cock and Bull. And that building is still standing. It's a Jaguar dealership now. And they have a big plaque right in front that says that's where the Moscow Mule was. I like plaques. Whenever I go, you know, mostly Europe, you try to walk around, you see who lived where. I think those are fascinating. And then we have the Hot Fudge Sundae from C.C. Brown's. That was introduced there. So those were the three items that
the Moscow Mule, one drink. Was it the Moscow Mule that was developed at one of these restaurants?
Well, you just said that.
Yeah. Oh, did you say that? I didn't hear that. Okay.
Yeah, over at the Cock and Bull restaurant did the Moscow Mule. And they had all the copper mugs lined up, and if you were anybody, like a star of some sort, they had your name engraved on the mug, so when you came, you could drink out of your own mug.
It's funny, Morton's of Chicago used to do that. I don't know if they still do that. After you'd had 10 martinis, you got your own glass, and you could keep it there. And because Miss Ann got hers, but they actually gave her hers before she got to 10. She was so famous, she was entitled to have one.
So another famous one is the hobo steak, which apparently you had to know about it because it wasn't really listed on the menu.
Yeah, they would do that also. And the other thing restaurants did is you didn't have their phone numbers unless you knew.
Right.
The maitre d's had power. And it's not like today where you just smile at the person at the front and you do open table. You really had to have the secret phone number to get the better tables. You even had to dress appropriately. There was one restaurant that back in the 70s and 80s, he had a camera situated. I didn't put this in the book, but he had a camera out in the parking lot to see if you were wearing appropriate clothes to be in certain parts of the dining room. And he'd call down to the maitre d' and say where to put them. And That section of the book, the gentleman is still alive, and he asked if we could take it out of the book, so we did. Because he gave us a lot of pictures, so we thought, okay, it wasn't that big.
So that was a fair trade, huh?
Yeah, we could be bought.
I actually interviewed a maitre d' once. He had been the maitre d' at the Savoy Hotel in London. And there were one of the things they had, and maybe this also happened in Los Angeles, but people would have their favorite table.
Oh, yeah.
And they would
arrive
for dinner, and they would be expected to sit at their favorite table. And the maitre d' was supposed to know which table it was. So I asked him, what happens if two people came wanting the same table as their favorite table? And he said, we put a big vase of flowers on it, and neither of them sat there.
Yeah, the maitre d's had the power, and they were one of the highest paid people back in the 30s, 40s, some 50s. The maitre d' played orchestra with the people because certain stars. I get La Dome is one of the restaurants that they would put people in certain areas depending on if they were producers or if they were doing deals. They had one area no one wanted to sit at. It was called the hallway. Everyone said, oh, I got sat in the hallway. They didn't want to sit there. So So there was that going on a lot of the time, and to be seen. And the one little restaurant that not many people know of, it's called Shay J, and it's still in operation. It's down by the beach. But Table 10, and anybody can sit there pretty much, but they called it Table 10, and it was the most powerful table that so many things happened. The Kissinger papers were supposedly, and nobody's declared that it didn't happen because the Rand Corporation was around the corner. They were given there. There was Sinatra ate there a lot. Good Will Hunting, the movie, was written at that table, part of the whole thing with Ben Affleck. So a lot of things happened in this little tiny place that nondescript that not many people would know of, but I thought that had a lot of history, so I put that in the book also.
Well, you had fun.
Well, this is a glorious piece of social history.
Yeah, George. And it's all the big recipe. You also have little hamburger joints and drive-ins and all kinds of things in it. And you've got photographs of the actual menus. So, I mean, it's just a very rich history, and you could just sit down and read through the whole thing.
and we have been doing that, and we greatly enjoyed it, and we thank you for your contribution to the social history of the United States in the middle of the 20th century.
Well, early, actually. Well, early.
Yeah, it starts early. It gets to the middle.
19, yeah. But
thank you so much.
And it couldn't have come out at a better time because there's a restaurant revival, as I understand it, going on in L.A. right now.
Yeah. One last thing that I thought was fascinating when I was doing my research was because it's the political season, and we won't get political, but we had restaurants in the 80s that were Democrat restaurants and Republican restaurants.
Really?
And you didn't go to one if you were the other. And what's fascinating is the Democrat restaurant at the time was called Trump's.
Oh, my God.
That's brilliant. Absolutely brilliant.
It wasn't known by him, but that's what it was called.
I guess we better let that one run, and we won't make any more comments.
No, just to leave you with that little bit of information.
Time to go, George. Otherwise, we're only going to get into trouble.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
And finishing up today's program, a really interesting character, Richard Bertinet, is enough of an expert on bread that he's made it all the way from France to Britain, where he's revolutionizing the production of bread. First of all, I think on a what do you call it, an artisanal scale, but now he's just opened a whole new bakery in the center of England, and his customer is Sainsbury's, which is the largest supermarket chain in the United Kingdom.
So yeah, I like his titles.
He must be quite a character. Simple.
Dough.
Yeah, there you go. That's the name of the book. And if you're interested in baking bread, this is the one you got to get to direct you as to how to do it really successfully, because this man really knows what he's doing.
Oh, sure. Well, I'm going to give it a try again. I'm looking at this wonderful book by Richard Bertinet. It's called Dough, very simply, D-O-U-G-H, and it's subtitled Simple Contemporary Bread. And it's a reprint of a sort of his original cookbook, but it has the added advantage of a step-by-step DVD. And I think that's a great, tell us the story about how you got this DVD through your publisher, Richard.
Hey. When we finished writing the book, something inside me told me there was something missing. And I couldn't put any more picture in there. We tried to keep the book as clear as possible, with as little word as possible, and to make it self-explanatory. So we decided to do a DVD. So I didn't tell my publisher. We did a DVD, film it, edit it, keep it quite simple. And then I went for a meeting with them and said, I like this in the book. And they looked at me with big eyes and said, well, what do you mean? It's never been done before. I said, well, let's be the first to put a DVD with the book and use it as a tool. And I think it's the best thing we've done, because it just takes people a step closer to the feel of the dough and to the way things should look like and feel like. And it's been a lot of help for people.
Yes, now you were born and raised in Brittany, France. And from your introduction to your book, you knew at a young age that you wanted to be a baker, huh?
Yes, I mean, I knew at the age of 14 that school was not for me. So I remember at school one day they asked everybody, what do you want to do for a living? And I put my hand up for the job of a baker, and I became a baker from that day. So never put your hand up.
Yeah, but you now live in England, right?
Yes, I came in England for 2 weeks every day and stayed ever since. And I fell in love with the country. I love living in here.
What part do you live?
It's a great country.
Where do you live?
I live in a beautiful city of Bath.
Oh, I love Bath.
In the south west of England.
Oh, I love Bath.
Well,
yeah.
We can understand why you might like it.
It's great.
It's a stunning place.
We stayed at the Royal Crescent once, and we stayed at the Bath Priory another time.
Both
elegant establishments. I love the Royal Crescent, because there's no sign that says this is a hotel.
No, you've got to know it, and that's only about 2 minutes walk from the cooking school. So,
oh, no kidding!
We're very close to it. Yeah.
So in addition to bake, now do you bake bread commercially, or do you run a school, or do you do both?
Yes, no, I've got a big bakery now. So we've got two bakeries, one in Bath. And where we supply a lot of restaurant, farm shop, and local business, and another bigger bakery in Milton Keynes in the north of London, where we supply Waitrose supermarket, and we supply also some big chain of Pret à Manger, and also
Pret à Manger, yeah.
So you're big time in bread.
Quite a lot now. It's grown a lot the past 10 years.
It sounds like in there. Is that just because you make really good bread? What's the secret of your success?
I'm sticking to my principles, so I never compromise on what we do. So all the bread we're making is made in a natural way, in a proper way. I do a lot of training for my bakers, so we spend a lot of time training our chef and our bakers to do the right way. And never compromise with improvers and so on. So we do everything, you know, the best we can in an artisan way. We just relaunched a sliced bread in the country as well. So we're just relaunching our sliced sourdough. So we got the convenience of sourdough, but just with three ingredients into a loaf of bread now. So that's revolutionized bread in the country at the moment.
That'd be innovation there.
There's a little play on words in here that I want to pop in here. You probably know that one of the slang words for money in England is dough.
Absolutely.
and you seem to you have translated bread dough into folding green dough, if you like to think of it that way.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, the title of the book for me was important, and the fundamental thing to understand about my bread book was, you know, most bread books are called the bread Bible or bread this and bread, but you can't make good bread if you don't have a good dough, and you've got to start with a good dough first. And the book is centered into understand how dough work, and if you fall in love and make dough properly, you can make good bread. So all the titles of all my books are one word, so it's quite in your face and straightforward. So dough is the first one, and it your head, I think.
Now, when you break down your chapters into what you call mother breads, doughs, So you have white dough, olive dough, brown dough, rye dough, and sweet dough.
And sweet dough, yeah.
And then from there, in each chapter, you let people expand. And once they pick up some of your specialty ideas, then yeah. they can even expand further into making interesting breads. But these are interesting enough for me. I love them.
Yeah. I mean, bread is never-ending. I always say you can give a kilo of flour to 10 different bakers or 100 different bakers, and they will all do something different. So I always believe it's not about putting too many recipes in a book. I think what you try to do through a book is to inspire people, is to, when they open the book, they look at it and say, oh, I want to do this, I want to do this. And then when they get the master recipe and they understand the basic, then they can start doing their own thing, and they can become inspired by it.
Well, some of your recipes are quite inspired. I mean, I love this idea of serving seaweed bread with oysters.
Oh, it's fantastic. Yeah, the seaweed bread is great with it. I mean, there's plenty of variation on flavor. And I think when you start mixing little flavor together, it's very inspiring without making it too complicated. So the Perth bowl in there is fantastic. The soup bowl, you make a soup bowl with bread dough, so you can serve your soup, you know, in a soup bowl made with bread. So there's some quite wacky ideas, but I think they do work.
Well, you do flat breads, you do bread sticks. Now, here's one that I like, the prosciutto, parmesan, and pine nut bread.
That's really nice.
I love that.
Yeah. There's plenty for everybody. And I think to have the five chapter, and a lot of people will say, oh, I like brown bread. So there's chapter with wholemeal dough, you know, and spelt and all the stuff of different grain, and more wholesome bread. And the sweet one, you got, you know, you can make your donuts, you can make all sorts of things. So it's quite clear division in the book, to take you through different, variation, which I think keep people exciting enough to start with.
You know, you advocate so that you always have fresh bread, that you can actually freeze it, par-bake it and freeze it.
Absolutely, yeah. There's nothing wrong with people always think it takes time and it's laborious. It's not. It's just planning. You know, it's get a bit of planning. And if you got only one day a week to make your own bread, you can make it and par-bake it and freeze it. So you always got fresh bread. There's nothing wrong doing that. You know, it's you learn to handle all this. So I don't see any problem with that at all.
Well, I would put in one warning here. Don't do as Peter and I did when we had some extra loaves of bread. We wrapped them in a plastic thing and sealed it with our food saver, which unfortunately sucked all the air out of the bread.
Oh dear!
That
yeah.
was not good.
You could build houses with the bread.
Well, you need some bricks for the wall. Oh dear!
Oh dear! So, Peter, you said.
What did I say? I can't remember now. No, I do remember. I can't remember the name of the chef at Le Manoir, Quatre Saisons.
Oh, Raymond Blanc.
Raymond Blanc. And when we talked to Raymond, he recounted how he came over to England in the early 1970s, I think, as a waiter, and then single-handedly rescued British cuisine, at least according to him. Do you claim that?
He is. I know Raymond very well. And
yeah.
he's a real gentleman. He's a real pioneer of the cuisine, and what he's done over the 35 years in here is incredible. You know, his place is phenomenal, and the people who came to work under him are amazing people and talented chefs. So, you know, I think Britain owned him quite a lot as well. So,
what I was thinking was that you seem to have emulated his success in the restaurant business, coming over from France to England and just baking bread, which doesn't sound like all that difficult. Doesn't sound like it could be different.
It's wonderful bread,
but apparently you must be really good at it.
I hope so. I met Prince Charles once, and we won an award for our bread. And I had a chat with him. He came. He said, it took a French man to show the English how to make bread. They were, you know, so he was very nice about it, and a real gent as well. But I guess what I'm trying to do with the book is to teach people the basic. You know, it's a skill, and
right.
The skill is something you learn from the basic. You don't learn a skill by learning the end bit. So start with the beginning. Understand how things work. And
well, why don't you have to flour your surface? Would you work in kneading your bread? I don't understand that.
But if you do that, you change the recipe. You never add flour when you knead the dough in a mixer. So why do it by hand? And that's where everything starts to go wrong. People don't understand how to handle dough.
Yeah, but my mother and grandmother always floured everything.
Yeah, but that's if you go back all the way to the 14th century, Middle Ages, that's the way they used to do it. And we stopped doing that in the late 1700s when we understood that if the bread was too heavy and dense, it was not digestible. It was very hard on the guts. So if you look at the evolution of baking, when electricity was powering all the bakery, all the mixer were developed to add air and incorporate more air and make the dough lighter and more supple. So the bakery industry has changed, but the way of making bread at home never changed. We still bake in the dark ages. We still need pass it on the recipe from grandmother to daughters and so on.
That's my problem.
Nothing moved on. So it's if you look at the mixer and the bakery industry, you stick to the recipe. You don't change the recipe by adding flour every 2 seconds onto your table or put oil. That's a new fashion. You know, you stick to what your recipe is. So there's a big discrepancy between working in the bakery and doing things by hand at home.
Uh-huh.
Now,
so,
where do you come down on no-knead bread? We've had a variety of mixed opinions. We've had people who swear by no-knead bread.
No-knead, you got that?
Well, the no-knead bread is nothing new. I mean, this was first, if you put water and flour together, there's a self-mixing. It's called autolyse. And the autolyse technique was developed in the 70s by Professor Calvel in France. And no-knead bread is fine. You can make a few loaves like that by hand in your kitchen. The problem is not practical if you start doing it on a big scale in a bakery. So, you know, if it takes 3 hours to mix, your dough is not very productive. So it's a different way of making bread. It's a different way of making bread. So, you know, some people swear by it. I don't use it. I think you make your dough, you let it rest for 3, 4, 5 hours or overnight, and you deal with it. You can't make baguette. You can't make you can't shape anything with a no-knead dough. It's too liquid and it doesn't work.
Oh, that's
that
a good thought. Yeah.
So it's a different way of making bread.
I think this guy knows what he's talking about.
I think he knows what he's talking about too.
we're on our way from London to Cornwall at Christmas time. Maybe we'll stop by and pick up a couple of loaves.
Yeah.
Where do you come down on this? I mean, I know people who now mill their own flour, and they're using all these ancient grains, and they're using wild yeast. It all sounds very complicated.
I know. But again, talking about flour, when we opened our bakery, I was probably one of the first ones in the UK to age with flour. I never used fresh flour. Fresh flour is, if you go back when I was in France, I always remember working in a bakery, we would never dream of having a fresh flour delivery. Our flour was always 2 or 3 weeks old before we use it. So when the flour rests, it oxidizes, it rests, is less tense, if you know what I mean. So you absorb better and it's more digestible. So a lot of problem with allergies we've got and intolerance in this world now is because we use too much fresh wheat. And on big scale, it's really bad for your guts. So that's what stone ground flour is, much easier on your guts. But so all our flour we use in our bakery is always rested for 2 or 3 weeks before we use it. So that's another thing now. It becomes very fashionable in England. So everybody wants their flour to be rested because we started.
This is amazing. I think we all agree with Prince Charles. we're glad you made it across the channel. I'm sure Britain will be forever grateful, and one of these days you'll get an OBE or an MBE or something like that.
Yeah, it should. It probably does.
Based on bread.
One of the biggest compliments we had is when the book came out in a hard copy in a state, I had a call from my publisher, who was in New York at the time, said, you won. I said, won what? He said, you won a James Beard Award.
Oh, yes, you did.
I didn't know what James Beard was at the time. And now I realize how important the James Beard Award was. And then the week after, they called me back and said, you won again.
IACP.
The IACP Award and the Julia Child and all those things now I realize when I see who won those prizes in the state is unbelievable. So I know the book had a big impact and, you know, I've had a lot of people from America coming, every month we've got people from America coming to do breakfast with us. They will travel all the way.
Really?
So we're doing something right and that's the biggest compliment for me.
Well, I don't know how well you know your British history, but there have only been three Richards. There have been eight Georges, but there have only been three Richards. I'm proposing a fourth. Richard Bertinet the fourth. Thank you so much for joining us today.
I'm so hungry. This book is just delicious. Okay.
It's been informative, but it's also been fun.
Maybe we should
anytime. You've got my number. You can call me anytime.
Okay. Richard, it's been a real pleasure. Thank you.
Well, we hope the rest of your day goes as well as the day you spent with us here at On the Menu. We're once again a very, very happy Christmas.
Happy holidays to all of you.
All of that good stuff. And we'll see you again, same time, same place, next week on the 1st of January, 2017, our 14th year. And what do we say?
Bye-bye.